rights programs. That would be nice. If you're interested in civil rights and you want to attend one of our subcommittee meetings, the next subcommittee meeting is going to be May 31st, Wednesday, I guess. You know, I guess Tuesday is the 30th. I misspoke myself. It's Tuesday, the 30th, between 6 and 7 that Rotkin is going to be speaking. I hope you make that correction. And it's at that time, between 6 and 7 at 322 Maple Street, if you want to come to watch Rotkin on cable TV and call in on my phone, you're welcome to do that. That's the 30th, not the 31st. It is Tuesday. On Wednesday, the 31st, the Civil Rights Subcommittee of the Above the Line Community Coalition meets. And if you want to get information, you can't come to this meeting, because coming to meetings is always a drag. Give a call to 457-9754. That's 457-9754. And there are a number of subcommittees. My Civil Rights Subcommittee is 266. So you dial 457-9754, and then you dial 266. You want to catch the Youth Subcommittee, you dial 265. If you want to catch emergency shelter and register a complaint about tents not being allowed out at River Street, you dial 457-9754, and you dial 264. So again, subcommittees are the emergency shelter at 264, youth at 265, civil rights at 266. And you can leave a message, and you'll also be able to get some information. This is a useful way of getting information to a lot of people fast, because this coalition covers 50 or 60 people, some of them business people, some of them social service providers, some of them activists like myself. And again, if you want to come to a meeting, it's noon. Call that number to get the exact time of the meeting. I thought it was noon, but I think it also may have been moved to 8:30 in the morning on May 31st on Wednesday, and it's at 1301 Broadway, Apartment C. But give a call and you can get more information at 457-9754. You know, I just got back from Santa Barbara. Hey, you know, before I go into any more of this, let me give you a chance to ease up and hear somebody else's voice for once. I know I'm extremely interesting, and everybody loves to hear me, and I love to hear myself talk. But I have a couple of things done by the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, which is a troupe that Carol Denny's on that I promised you. And I'm going to try to put this tape on. Unfortunately, our taping facilities are down, as you heard at the beginning of the era, the beginning of the program. So I may get you into the middle of a show, but I want you to bear with me. And we'll see if how we're doing here. Actually, rewind this turkey to the beginning, and you can actually hear the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, which is a satirical comedy troupe on Berkeley Radio. Now, I'd love to see some folks get together, a satirical comedy troupe, here on... Is this right? I guess so. A satirical comedy troupe here in Santa Cruz. I mean, we need a satirical comedy show. So all you frustrated dramatists out there, Nutcracker Nick Whitehead, Nutcracker Nick wrote this wonderful show called, Homeless in Santa Cruz. It was a great parody of the of what happened after the earthquake for the homeless, and very funny show. He actually did it in the park. And he videotaped it. But we need some satire, some local satire. And this Jolly Roger comedy troupe is an example of what can be done. It's just amazing. I mean, it's just a lot of funny, good stuff. And here's what it sounds like. I think we're going to be coming on here shortly.
One curious aspect of the current Federal Communications Commission is its seeming arbitrary assignment of uncollectible fines to people accused of broadcasting without licenses. How does the FCC structure its fines? Is there actually some kind of system? To find out, we asked an FCC agent shivering in a van, frantically twisting dials outside the suspected location of a pirate broadcaster. Mr. FCC agent, is there actually some kind of system?
Of course we have a system. It's just too complicated for lay people to understand. We take the average daily temperature divided by the current interest rate, factor in the price of gasoline, premium gasoline that is, and then multiply by 14% of the amount of people who voted in the latest mayoral election, according to the municipality of the radio pirate in question, subtract 29, and there you have it, a rational, objective formula for the assignment of fines to pirate radio broadcasters.
I see. Was this method always used for assigning fines?
No, we used to use a dartboard and a blindfold, but it was suggested to us that this might be perceived as somewhat arbitrary. Being good public servants, we began a course of serious study with renowned experts to refine this method.
What other methods have been used?
Well, for a few years, we experimented with an FCC secretarial pool lottery system, after which we moved to a more complicated formula based on the third horse race at Santa Anita. Then for several months, we relied on adding up the numbers of the first 40 license plates through the Bay Bridge toll plaza at midnight. These, of course, are valuable indicators, but we believe our current methods offer a truly scientific rationale.
Will the FCC be further improving its current fine selection method?
Well, we take our duty to discourage pirate broadcasting extremely seriously. So, despite the fact that we have no way of actually collecting any of these fines, we tirelessly continue to experiment with fine structures, hoping that someday the pirate broadcasters will surrender their headphones in defeat. Our latest experiments involve an inverse ratio of atmospheric negative ions to salt content in canned soup, carefully factoring in other numerical indicators such as football scores and stock prices. The American people can be proud.
Of course. We have been listening to an FCC field agent explaining the creative aspects of the FCC fine structure. Back to you in the studio.
Hold it right there, Batman. Border Patrol. Pull that sleigh over here to the side of the road.
Well, I'm in a bit of a hurry.
Save it, Batman. You just crossed the border there into the U.S. of A.
Ah, yes. I've just finished delivering presents to all the children of Mexico.
Right. Yeah. Let's see your papers.
Well, I do have my lists here, the naughty list and the nice list, but I'm afraid that's privileged material.
Oh, is that right?
Confidential, you know.
Batman, let me give you a clue here. Lose the attitude. This is the Border Patrol. We're not in the mood for comedy on Christmas Eve.
Well, that's just it, you see. I'd like to help you out here, boys, but it's Christmas Eve, and the reindeer and I have a long way to go.
Yeah, you got any weapons in this sleigh?
No.
What's that by your gear shift, fat man?
Oh, that's the club.
The club, huh?
Well, yes, you can't be too careful these days.
All right, Ray, let's see some ID.
But I don't need any identification, sir. I'm Santa Claus.
Yeah, right, and I'm the Easter Bunny. What's in the sleigh, fat man?
Why, toys and presents for all the children of the world.
Let me guess, and you're from the North Pole, huh?
Why, of course.
Now that's it, fat man. Step out of the sleigh, please.
But, officers, it's Christmas Eve, and I still have four continents to go.
You've had a change of plans, fat man. We don't take kindly to foreigners in these parts taking our jobs and using up our services.
But, officers, all Santa Claus ever does is spread peace, joy, and gender-appropriate manufactured goods.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got a present for you, Mr. Santa Claus, don't we, boys?
Yeah, I think we do, yeah.
That's the truth.
No shit.
Yeah, a pretty pair of bracelets and a quick trip back over the border.
Yeah. And your little dogs, too.
But you'll ruin Christmas Eve for millions of children.
Hands behind your back.
But Johnny wants a pair of skates.
Party's over, fat man. Take
him
away, boys.
It's a diaphragm for a Barbie doll.
Finally closing the border on these preloading porters. Gotta draw the line, right, boys?
That's right.
Oh, and Merry Christmas, boys.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Come on,
Batman. The administration is moving troops to the Adriatic. We'll have more details later in our broadcast, but a more important local story is breaking right now on the shopping beat. Let's have a consumer report from Penny Greenback in Union Square.
We're here in Union Square with the Consumer Report, where the shopping picture looks very good for retailers. Shoppers are jammed elbow to elbow on the sidewalks, and our camera crew can hardly breathe. You'd better take it in the studio. We've got to get out of here or somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah, looks pretty serious out there, Penny. Can you tell us the mood of the shoppers? Penny? Well, it seems we've lost contact with our correspondent in Union Square. Let's move over to Van Ness and Gough, where Buck Moneylover has a story breaking live. Buck?
It's an amazing shopping miracle taking place out here, Joe. Pull the camera in for a tight shot. And here, yes, yes, there it is! A parking spot has opened up here at the corner of Van Ness and Gough. Live in front of our cameras. And look out! Oh, it's pretty frightening out here, Joe, but these are dedicated shoppers with only one thing on their minds.
What do you think you're doing?
Oh, this battle between an Accord and a Volvo is pretty ugly, and it doesn't look like it's going to resolve itself anytime soon. Back to you, Joe.
What an incredible sight, Buck. Thanks for that remarkable coverage, and please be careful. We have some news of the American troop movements in Europe later in our broadcast. But first, an important shopping update from Duncan Cover, testing the regular three-tail waters at Kmart in Emeryville. Duncan?
It's incredible, Joe. The lines at the cash registers disappear beyond the horizon. People are actually camped out, waiting for the next shipment of Chia Pet. This young woman reflects the mood of the crowd. Miss, what brings you here to Kmart today?
Must spend money. Must spend money.
I tell you, it's chaos, Joe. The computer games, the pantyhose, the Disney videos, they're flying off the shelf, and the crowds just keep demanding more and more. We've got to get out of here.
Thank you, Duncan. Duncan? Well, we're having some kind of technical difficulty over at Kmart, but we ought to bring you an update on the American troop movements in Syria. And we'll do that just as soon as we check in with our consumer expert, Willa Chargealot, at the food court near the corner of Franklin and Pine. Willa?
Table space is pretty scarce here at the food court, Joe, where shoppers are paying dearly for... Something's happening here, Joe! A madman armed with automatic rifles is spraying the crowd with bullets! And these shoppers are still determined to hold their places in line! I've never seen anything like this. It's madness. People are stepping over the bodies, charge card in hand, and maintaining consumer readiness despite the danger and the gunfire. They're still shopping as though their lives depended on it. We've got to get out of here, Joe.
Well, Willa, can you tell us the mood of the madman, Willa? We've lost our reporter at Franklin and Pine. Sounds as though, despite the difficulties, we should have a great shopping season this year. We'd like to bring you an update on the troop movements in Central America, but we're out of time. Be sure to catch more late-breaking details on our retail shopping climate at 11. This is Joe Mama at National Corporate Radio.
And this is Robert Bathrobes, Pierre Robert, at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM. And you've been listening to the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, a Berkeley satirical group, which is on Radio Free Berkeley. And you're listening to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides here on Radio Free Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM. Do you have any comments, questions? If you're interested in going on the air yourself, do give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, or 423-4833, which is the not the number of the station, but it is my number, and you can get in touch with me. And I can get in touch with you and find out what you've been thinking about this show, which is a twice-weekly show, Monday and Friday, usually from 10 to 12 or 12:30. Sometimes we kind of spill over if we can. Today we're going to probably be spilling over a bit because we started late. Tip of the hat to Uncle John, who was taping the show for us. Our taping is, we got problems here at the station and can't tape the show, but it's important to do that because then it can go out over other sister stations up north and down south and all over the place. And it's not just you that are hearing it, but it becomes an archival document so other people can hear it and so it can be passed on. Also, if you find that you can't hear the show, if the transmission is bad or if it's distorted or blared, or if you have any suggestions for the radio station, please give me a call at 423-4833. I'm interested. So before I left for the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, I was going to tell you a quick update on Santa Barbara, where I was working for a year as a homeless advocate and recently visited. Santa Barbara is a wealthy town of the South, about twice, three times the size of Santa Cruz. However, it's a somewhat mellower town. Didn't used to be in terms of how homeless people are treated. Their sleeping ban, for instance, is less harsh than ours. Our sleeping ban in Santa Cruz makes it illegal even to sleep on much private property. Anytime you fall asleep or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night up until 8:30 in the morning, you are criminal. And two such instances can be the basis for a six-month jail sentence in theory, although that has not been the case in practice. But it has been the cause for continuing and harassment and incredible harassment of people, and just people who are trying to live. I mean, not people who are littering the area, not people who are defecating or urinating in public places, not people who are blocking sidewalks, but people who have gone off into the boonies, the Pogonip, under a bridge, to try to find a place to sleep. And often, because they have to avoid both the police, they get hit by even worse people, like trollbusters, as we call them, people who get a kick out of hurting homeless people. That happened recently with the Gale brothers, two trollbusters who were convicted of beating four homeless men with pipes and sentenced to, like, it was 4 to 8 years in jail. One of the men has since died, allegedly from causes other than the beatings. But the insecure situation of people outside continues. There's only facilities in Santa Cruz. Even considering the open-air shelter, the back 40, the campground at the juncture of Highway 1 and River Streets, even considering that area and the entire Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, no more than 150 to 200 spots. And there's at least between 800 and 1,500 homeless people in the city. And the Department of Social Services estimated 1988, 3,000 to 5,000 in the county. So it's it means that the overwhelming majority of homeless people are illegal at night. And in Santa Cruz, if you fall asleep at night, or if you cover up with blankets at night, even with the permission of a property owner that you're on, unless you're in a fenced-in side yard or backyard, or inside a domicile, you can be ticketed for violating Municipal Code 6.36, the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, a ban that has remained in place undebated for a decade under the so-called Progressive City Council, whether the mayor was Marty Wormhout, whether the mayor was John Laird, whether the mayor was Mike Rotkin, whether the mayor was Don Lane, whether the mayor was Catherine Byers. That issue has never come up on the agenda. Even Celia Scott, the attorney who spoke against the downtown ordinances last year at City Council, has not had the temerity, I would say the courage, or perhaps we would say the good sense, to bring this issue publicly to the fore. Instead, we have heard for 6 months that there is a so-called vehicular camping law amendment that they're considering, but they haven't even held final meetings on it. This is 6 months later. While police continue to give tickets to homeless people who sleep outside, while people outside continue to live in fear of a midnight knock on their van, while our community has to suffer the humiliation of being a community that denies people basic human rights because the city council, which roars and rolls to power on the basis of liberal and so-called progressive credentials, which gets the student votes, which brags about its social services, hasn't got the basic decency to allow people the right to sleep at night in Santa Cruz. I mean, it's a disgrace. But it's what we're faced with. And unfortunately, we're faced with it statewide because there was recently the Tobe decision was overturned by the California Supreme Court, in which the laws in Santa Ana, which were found unconstitutional by a Fourth District Court of Appeals, finally got to the California Supreme Court. And the California Supreme Court said, hey, if you want to make laws against sleeping, that's fine. Doesn't violate the right to travel, doesn't violate the right to due process, doesn't violate their right to be free from cruel and unusual punishments. And a national commentator, a right-winger named George Will, talked about how he supported this decision. But I just got a letter from the guy who was the lead counsel in this case, the guy who said the people of Santa Ana who are poor and homeless should be allowed to sleep at night. They shouldn't be driven away from where they are if there's no legal place for them to be, as long as they're not violating other laws. He wrote this letter to me. Actually, he wrote this response to George Will's column. Unfortunately, I don't have Will's column with me. I'll have to reserve that for a future time. But here is his response. The belief that the level of political discourse in this country has dropped to an all-time low received vindication recently from an unlikely source, George Will. Will is normally a thoughtful conservative commentator, more likely to quote obscure Greek philosophers than to engage in ad hominem invective. So when Will chose to write about Santa Ana's ordinance making it a crime for homeless people to sleep under a blanket in a public place, one would expect a balanced discussion of the difficult policy questions raised. Right? Wrong. In a remarkable diatribe, blaming civil rights lawyers for homelessness, crime, lack of school discipline, and mental illness, surprisingly, Will left out war and pestilence from his list, Will makes the following point. Attorneys who represent homeless people often do not themselves live in poor neighborhoods. Newsflash. Neither do the police who arrest the homeless, the attorneys who prosecute them, the judges who sentence them, or, it must be said, the columnists who pontificate about the, quote, culture of poverty. Of all these groups, only the police are as likely as poverty lawyers to work in poor neighborhoods. So what? Surely Will does not propose that we can resolve the great issues of the day through a litmus test of zip code correctness. Will understandably is frustrated by the sight of people living on public sidewalks or in the parks. Who isn't? But does Will seriously believe that arresting people for sleeping in a park is even a partial solution? In the short run, arresting homeless people in Santa Ana will send them a message. They should move to Fullerton, Orange, and other nearby cities. Those cities, of course, will enact their own, quote, anti-camping ordinances until every city has one of its own. Then what? Even assuming in the three strikes era there is room in our jails to house camping ordinance violators, eventually they will return to the streets. Whatever one believes are the causes of homelessness, nothing will change. Many believe that a major problem is a rapidly shrinking supply of affordable housing, such as the single-room occupancy hotels that used to house the poor and the mentally ill. Arresting homeless people will not build a single apartment. Even if one believes, as Will apparently does, that homelessness is entirely an individual problem, arrests still will not solve anything. Take, for example, the problems of the homeless mentally disabled, a significant portion of the homeless population. Contrary to popular myth, California law permits involuntary confinement and treatment of people so mentally disabled they cannot care for themselves. And the overwhelming majority of the homeless mentally disabled people, 86% according to one study, accept medication when offered to them. Bathrobe's Pierre Roberts interruption. These are not my views. These are the views of Harry Simon, attorney. I'm not particularly good on medication, nor do I praise people accepting medication. Nor do I particularly like the classification mentally ill, by the way. I think it's a way of stigmatizing and demeaning. Why then are there so many so-called crazy people on the streets? The answer, according to a finding of the California legislature, is that in many counties, including Orange County, there is an extreme shortage of mental health services, which has resulted in the redirection of long-term psychiatric patients from the mental health system into the criminal justice system or into a state of homelessness. Don't blame civil rights lawyers for that. And again, I interrupt Harry's letter here to say that I would be more concerned about the absence of housing and job placement services, or just the availability of jobs. Even when some treatment is available, it does not necessarily take people off the streets. As one study puts it, asking the patient to return home, take the medication, rest, and come back tomorrow is a meaningless intervention when home is an alley and rest is impossible. One of our clients, Mildred Belazaire, a 37-year-old woman, though she was regularly taking the medication her doctors had prescribed, the medication did not enable her to earn enough income to afford an apartment. Could be that the failure to have rent control laws also assisted in that situation, or assisted in the continuation of a bad situation. Nor could she find temporary shelter in a city which, according to its own figures, has 10 times as many homeless people as shelter beds. So on a rainy night, Ms. Belazaire was arrested under the Santa Ana Ordinance for the crime of sitting in a tunnel while reading a Bible tract and covering her legs with a blanket to keep warm. No one, not George Will, not Miss Belazaire, and certainly not her lawyers, could be happy that Miss Belazaire was sitting in that tunnel. Well, I don't know about that. But only Will, however, apparently believes that the problem will end with the arrest of Miss Belazaire or the disappearance of her attorneys. Not as good as I'd hoped, but I'm glad that Harry Simon is pursuing this case. It was amazing. It was the first state court decision which threw out camping laws, and for a while we were hopeful on that law, although we have the worst California Supreme Court in I don't know how long. So the hope we have now around the anti-camping laws and in the court situation is that the federal courts may give us some kind of relief. In Miami, for instance, the Pottinger decision came down, which held the city of Miami could not arrest people for sleeping and carrying on necessary life functions if they have no alternatives. And that is still the case in Miami, and that may become a federal standard here if taken to federal court, if we can find the attorneys to do it. Again, in Santa Cruz, we have virtually no legal support. It's disgraceful. Local American Civil Liberties Union, just not interested. They are pursuing the Lisa Henry appeal, which will be coming back in July, and I believe the City Council had it on its litigation session, which is a closed session. City Council considers whether to instruct the city attorney to keep pursuing certain cases. Lisa Henry, as some of you may know, was an activist for the Coalition to Decriminalize Poverty, which was an ad hoc group got together last year to fight the downtown ordinances and stop the harassment of people on the streets and stand up for the rights of poor people. In fact, anybody downtown who wanted to be able to sit down on the sidewalk without being told to move along. And she was arrested by police, and the judges here locally said this law is unconstitutional. But the city attorney wouldn't accept that, and the district attorney, Art Danner, wouldn't accept that, so they are appealing it with your money, and it's still going on. And that case is still being discussed, and it's taking up city council time, even though a month after the laws were thrown out, the city passed new laws, somewhat different laws, that make it illegal to sit down on the sidewalk near a shop, near a telephone, near a drinking fountain, or 50 feet from an ATM. So that's what our budget-minded city council is doing. You might ask Mike Rotkin about that if you want to call him up on Tuesday between 6 and 7 when he's in his call-in talk show on Channel 71. Again, if you don't have a TV, call at 425-4920 after 6:20 p.m. on May 30th. That's Tuesday, next Tuesday. Or come by my place at 322 Maple Street, and we're going to have a watch-a-thon. We're going to watch Big Mike up there and make a few phone calls to him and see what he has to say about the issues that we think are important. Well, I've amassed a whole bunch of clippings here, clippings which I think might interest you guys out there and you gals out there in the audience. We're getting close to noon, but I'm going to kind of slop over a little bit since John has told me he's going to tape some of this stuff. I'm going to slop over and pass on a few articles and do a few things I usually do here. I usually read from a book called Radicalism in America, which is a history of radicalism by author Sidney Lenz. Sidney Lenz is an old-time radical, been dead for a couple decades now, I think. But he really was an interesting writer. He wrote a lot about areas of American history that most of us never hear about. And his book, I think, is out of print. Although one of his books is still in print, or not, isn't in print, it's in the library if you're interested. It's, what is it called? It actually was published after this book. It's called The Making of the American Empire. And it really covers stuff that even other radical historians like Harvey Wasserman and Harold Zinn do not cover. So I encourage all you history buffs out there who are looking for alternate views of U.S. history to check out Sidney Lenz on American history. And you may remember last time, if you follow the show or if you happen to be listening, we talked about, we read about Bacon's Rebellion back in the 1600s, one of the first rebellions in U.S. history. And we got as far as the end of that rebellion, which was in the 1670s. And we're going to read you a little bit more now from Colonial Rebels, a chapter from Radicalism in America by Sidney Lenz. The same year, the infection from Bacon's Rebellion spilled over to both Maryland and Albemarle. Albemarle is what is now called North Carolina. William Davies and John Pate massed a group of 60 men in Calvert County, Maryland, to denounce taxation and franchise policies, as well as to inform the Catholic proprietor, that is the guy who headed the state, Maryland was a Catholic state at that time, that they had no intention of swearing a loyalty oath. The gathering was broken up as an act of treason and its two leaders hanged. The storm, however, could not be stilled. New revolts broke out in 1681 and again in 1689 with somewhat more success. In Albemarle, George Durant and John Culpepper disputed the right of the proprietor's agent to collect quit rent, a tax in lieu of rents formerly paid to feudal lords, and certain tobacco imposts. Their resistance was sufficient to have the agent recalled and to win the release of Durant from jail, but in North Carolina, as in Maryland and Virginia, no permanent changes were made in the colonial structure. The next radical offensive in 1689 gained its momentum from events overseas. The people of Britain in the Glorious Revolution of 1688 had forced King James II to abdicate. Parliament was again in the saddle and hopes ran high for social change. As the news filtered back to the colonies after March 1689, it inspired a series of complementary revolts in New England, New York, Maryland, and North Carolina. In Boston, there was a minor uprising with little bloodshed in which Governor Andros and some of his advisors were arrested. As a result, all of the New England colonies won back some of the autonomy that they had enjoyed in the past. In New York, the situation turned more serious. There, a German merchant, Captain Jacob Lessler, mounted a rebellion that lasted for more than a year. The authoritarian government of New York, dominated by the landlords and merchants, Bayard, Van Cortlandt, and Schuyler, were roundly hated by the small tradesmen, farmers, fishermen, and workers. From 1674 on, there had been disturbances by mechanics demanding better arrangements with their employers. Finally, in 1689, encouraged by the uprising in London, Lessler marched into the streets, seized the fort of New York, and unceremoniously uprooted the proprietary government. Joined by militia who mutinied against British troops, he was able to consolidate his hold over most of the colony from 1689 to early in 1691. His enemies said that Lessler's motives were personal, to avoid payment of customs duties, but he was immensely popular with the masses, so much so that the change in regime took place without a drop of blood. It was never known in the memory of man, one of his supporters stated, that ever a revolution or change of government was more regular. Once in power, Lessler began to overhaul the rancid colonial structure toward democracy. Free men gained the right to vote. The legislature was elected for the first time. Certain trade and land monopolies were dissolved. The tax system reformed, and a committee of safety set up for democratic defense. Though he swore fealty to Protestant King William, the king appointed a governor to supersede him and sent in troops to regain control. Lessler and his son-in-law were arrested, presumably to be held until the crown could make a final decision on their fate. But the governor, Colonel Henry Slaughter, who fiercely disliked the rebels, signed their death warrant anyway. Lessler was hanged, and most of his work undone, but it is worth noting that a few years later, the British Parliament posthumously removed the attainder for treason against Lessler's name. The New York Assembly paid an indemnity of £2,700 to his heirs. Looking back, it is evident that the 17th century turbulence did little to alter the colonial system per se or end injustices, but it did prevent a tightening of the social fabric. It was a damper on those who would have made America a carbon copy of Tory England or reactionary Europe. The same purpose was served in the 18th century by a less dramatic but an equally insistent wave of revolts, blending finally with the Revolution. Those in New York spanned most of the century, beginning with 1711 times, took place annually. The grievances were monotonously the same in colony after colony. Tight money, high rents, corruption, heavy taxes, the excessive political power of the rich. In New York, four families, the Van Cortlandts, Phillipses, Livingstons, and Van Rensselaers, had accumulated through favoritism, speculation, and graft a domain of 1,600,000 acres by 1697. They were virtually small emperors, like the dukes and counts of Europe. Their tenants, on the other hand, had little chance of ever owning a piece of land for themselves. Writhing under the burden of rents and discriminatory taxes, unable to gain relief in the controlled courts, they took to repeated agrarian disturbance. In the armed uprising of Hudson River Valley, farmers in 1766, the landlords had to call in British troops, since the home militia proved unreliable. 80 rebels were arrested, pilloried, fined. One of their leaders, William Prendergast, was sentenced to be hanged, but no one could be found to act as executioner. To avoid further riots, the governor had him pardoned. Throughout the 1740s and up to 1754, New Jersey farmers, especially in the eastern portion of the state, were similarly engaged in frequent insurgency. They defied court orders, broke up auction sales of defaulted farms, and attacked the prisons to rescue farmers incarcerated for debt. The militia called in to subdue the farmers in 1740 mutinied rather than shoot their neighbors. In one of their proclamations, the farmers expressed goals that were clearly socialistic. Quote, "No man," they said, "is naturally entitled to a greater proportion of the earth than another. Land was made for the equal use of all." One of the most prolonged resistances was the one of North Carolina regulators in the 1760s and early 1770s. It was directed against government chicanery. Officials in five Piedmont counties regarded their offices as an investment. In an audit of sheriff's accounts in 1769, it was found that the law enforcers were delinquent to the tune of £64,000. The unfortunate taxpayer was bilked ceaselessly by unscrupulous collectors who charged more than legally due. Defaulted farms were sold by the insiders to friends at deflated prices and then resold at extortionate profits. If a farmer sought the aid of a court, this is what he might encounter, according to one contemporary report. For entering the judgment on the court docket and issuing the execution, the work of one long minute, the justice of the peace demands 41 shillings and 5 pence. Unable to pay the fee, the unfortunate debtor is confronted with the alternative of a distraint or 27 days' work on the justice's plantation. We pause briefly. And we're back. Sometimes trying to run the phones and cover the station at the same time is a little difficult. So briefly, finishing up this Sidney Lenz chapter here from Radicalism in America, we're talking about the origins of radicalism, how radicalism has contributed to a freer society, a juster society. Even after he has worked out his debt to the justice, the poor man's account is not settled. There is the damned lawyer's mouth to stop. You empowered him to confess that you owed £5, and you must pay him 30 shillings for that, or else go to work 19 days for that pickpocket. And when that is done, you must work as many days for the sheriff for his trouble, and then you can go home to see your living wretched and tore to pieces to satisfy your merchant. Sounds like community service in Santa Cruz. You have to pay for that. It was no wonder that the regulators resisted for years until in 1771, Governor Tryon was able at the Battle of Almonts to disperse them. Seven were hanged, many jailed, and others fled westward to establish the first permanent settlement in Tennessee. That the farmer, who constituted the majority of the population in colonial times, rose so often and so militantly indicates how turbulent was this era. As a matter of fact, not even at the height of the greenback and populist movements a century later was the rural population so desperate, and certainly not so violent. And then when I continue this reading next time, we're going to read about radical protest of the slave, Negro and white, because in those days there were white slaves as well as black slaves. But the black slaves, of course, had it worse. They were generally slaves forever, and the whites were indentured servants. So you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM, and you're listening to Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. It's sort of a combined show dealing with history, local homeless rights issues, problems of police abuse. Reports from different areas as to what's happening with homeless folks. And such like stuff. And I've got a bunch of announcements here that might interest you. Here's the Vampire Lesbians of Sodom and Sleeping Beauty Coma show this summer. Drop some acid and bring a friend. Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m., June 2nd through 24th, Santa Cruz Actors Theater, 1001 Center Street, Big Wig Productions. Wow. So if you're interested in this show, which I know nothing about, you give a call to them at 457-8886. Tickets, however, are $10. We have a petition here to oppose construction of a city police building in San Lorenzo Park. I was talking about that earlier. Sponsored by the Sierra Club. Contact the Lawn Bowlers in San Lorenzo Park if you're interested. That's the... I guess you got to know where that is. It's next to the county building, right across the San Lorenzo Walk Bridge. And... here's an issue for all you folks who have internet access, and maybe some of you who don't. There's a move in Congress to essentially censor the internet so that people will not be able to write about sexual subjects, won't be able to mention bombs, things of that sort. Doesn't look good. There's a thing called the Communications Decency Act coming up in the next 3 weeks. That would restrict rights to freedom of speech and freedom of expression online. And it's likely to, apparently more likely to pass than not, and people are getting worried about it. There is a senator who's offering an alternative to that Communications Decency Act, Senator Leahy. He's a strong civil liberties advocate, according to this email thing I've got here, according to this information I got off the internet. He's been the Senate's most vocal critic of the Communications Decency Act. He's taking great political risk, and previously there was a petition against this act which generated over 108,000 signatures on the net, which is becoming the fashionable place and the effective place to register your protest against congressional assaults on civil liberties and such like. Senator Leahy's bill, which would substitute for the bill that wants to censor the internet. Now, I'll give you a brief description of what this censorship bill is considering. Censorship bill criminalizes the transmission of constitutionally protected speech, including the private communications between consenting individuals. It would violate privacy rights by protecting system administrators who take steps to ensure that their networks are not being used to transmit prohibited content, even if those steps include reading all messages in violation of the Electronics Communications Privacy Act. This bill would fail to account for the unique characteristics of interactive media, including the tremendous control users have over the content they or their children receive. And it would give the Federal Communications Commission jurisdiction, over online speech by giving the FCC authority to establish rules governing the distribution of content online. That's the bill that Senator Leahy wants to stop by pushing forward his own bill. Leahy's bill, which is Senate Bill 714, would direct the Department of Justice and the Department of Commerce to commence a five-month study to examine current law enforcement authority to prosecute distribution of porno, whether any additional law or law enforcement resources are needed, the availability of technological capabilities consistent with the First Amendment and the free flow of information in cyberspace to protect children from accessing controversial commercial and non-commercial content, and ways to promote the development and deployment of such technologies. So if you're interested in this bill by Senator Leahy, there are two ways to sign. You can do so through World Wide Web, and you go to http://www.cdt.org/petition.html. Let me put it this way. If you've got a computer and you want to know ways to oppose this attack on free communication over the net, give me a call at 423-4833. Give Robert a call Bathrobe Spear Robert, 423-4833, and I will give you all these details so as not to bore the rest of our listeners with this. But it is happening. It is something that folks should be aware of. The Internet, it's accessible now to people who have who are richer and who have computers, but there are some poor people who have computers, too, or have access to them. Food Not Bombs people. People can get together and share a computer, and it's very important, like free radio is a way of communicating across the globe. I mean, it's one of the reasons for the successful revolutions in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union. The information got out through the Internet. Updates. Well, we had a meeting with the Santa Cruz mediators the other day. What are the Santa Cruz mediators, you may ask? Well, Santa Cruz mediators are people who are still actually looking for confirmed funding, but they are authorized by the city council and by the downtown merchants to seek peaceful solutions to problems downtown that are currently being resolved by merchant, essentially seizure of the sidewalks and merchant law. I mean, what's happening in Santa Cruz is if you want to set up a political table in front of a cafe, it's now illegal. If you want to sit down near a storefront, it's illegal. If you want to ask for spare change while sitting on a bench, it's illegal. If you want to ask for a dime after dark, it's illegal. All of these things, not because the conduct is abusive, not because you might be swearing or hassling or harassing or intimidating, but because the merchants feel it does not create the proper downtown climate, you see. And that, what that amounts to is the seizure of public space by the merchants downtown for their own purposes. And that is something that we cannot have. And the mediators are interested in finding ways to get together different groups of people from the community to find